This is a Defocus Media production.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the 2020 podcast, bringing clarity to business, entrepreneurship, and life. I am your host, Dr. Harbir Syan. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me here to learn and to grow. You know, I'm always trying to bring on guests that are going to help us learn and to advance our careers. Actually, doesn't matter which career you're in. However, if you're in the eye care industry, you are going to love my guest today because she is an amazing, amazing expert. She is the founder and director of eye care services and clinical research at the Perriman Eye Institute in Seattle, Washington. And she was just named to the power list of top 100 most influential women in ophthalmology by the ophthalmologist. She is none other than the dry eye master, Dr. Laura Perriman. Thank you so much, Dr. Perriman, for being here and joining me on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. That was such a sweet introduction.
Oh, that was a lot shorter than I wanted it to be. There's a whole long list of other things I easily could have said. One of them would have been that you did your residency and fellowship at UW. Go Huskies.
That's right.
For Husky fans up here. So how long have you been in? Did you grow up in the Seattle, Washington area, or did you move there?
Oh, well, I actually was raised in the wilds of Montana.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm a tough old Montana gal. My word is gold, and it just like I'm true to my word, and authenticity is one of those core values of growing up in a place like that. I was being ready to lend a helping hand because there's barns that need to be raised, you know, that kind of
that's amazing.
Culture. So yeah, I got myself to college. I always knew I wanted to be a doc since I was 12.
Yeah.
It was just something that I felt very compelled to do. But yeah, I got myself through college and met my future husband in college, and then moved up to Seattle where he's from. Yeah. He put him through law school by working as a molecular immunobiologist at Immunex, which is now part of Amgen, way back in the day, and got him through school. But that's where my passion for immunopathophysiology started, was at the bench of doing basic science, slicing, dicing pieces of DNA together and seeing what kind of cool proteins I could make out of it. It's so that's kind of where things started. And then
like a real scientist.
Yeah.
That's a real scientist. And then that and that grew into you, of course, going to medical school, doing your residency and fellowship. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your path, because I think this is something that's really important for up and coming, you know, students or new doctors, but even people who are experienced veteran physicians. It's important to know that it's not always that straightforward path that everybody follows, right? You know, most of us don't follow that path, and it's okay. And I'd love for you to share, you know, your path a little bit of when you graduated and you know, starting a family and all those things, if you wouldn't mind giving us maybe the abbreviated version of that.
Sure. Thanks for that. And I agree with you. I think it's important to be vulnerable and share your journey, because you don't know who else is struggling on their journey. And maybe you're a little bit of support or inspiration to help them keep going. So I actually really appreciate the question. And I'm much more comfortable with being vulnerable in my mature years than I was when I was younger. So I'm okay with it.
Yeah. I think it's something that comes with age and wisdom, right?
Yes.
You learn it's actually beneficial to be vulnerable and share those things.
Yeah, there's a lot of benefit in being open and vulnerable and just heart-centered. There's a lot of value in that, and it outweighs the fear.
For sure it does.
So anyway, yeah, that's, so I got my husband through law school. And then when he was done, I went back to medical school. That was always the plan. We just did it one at a time. Married 11 years before we had children. Wow. But I ended up taking 5 years off after finishing my fellowship in refractive and surgery and cornea. And it was interesting. Like, I always had in my mind I was going to be that rock star cataract surgeon. So I'm great with my hands. That's not what life ended up for me. So after fellowship, had my first daughter, thought, oh, 6 months, I'm going to go find a job. After 6 months, I'm like, wow, I'm really enjoying motherhood. This is really important. And I think I want to stay a little longer. And that turned into 5 years.
That's awesome.
And I was terrified to go back to work. I thought to myself, do I even remember how to drive a slit lamp? I was so afraid. But a family friend had a small boutique practice out in Redmond, Washington, family friend optometrist. And he's like, hey, Laura, do you want to like come work one day a week? You know, if you maybe find a nanny, you can come fill in. I can learn how to fly like I've always wanted to do. I'm like, that sounds awesome.
That's cool.
So that's one of the reasons why I'm so OB friendly is I think there's a lot of room for collaboration and sharing of care and sharing of resources in order to provide awesome care for patients. So yeah, I worked part-time for the longest time and then had a series of lemony snicket unfortunate events. I was diagnosed with breast cancer 10 years ago.
Oh.
And my anniversary is April 6th. Woohoo! We're good.
That's amazing. Just a
but
couple
yeah,
days
that was quite the detour. And then between that surgery and the treatment and all the reconstructions and all the between all of that,
yeah,
I tried to increase the amount of work, but didn't quite work. A couple of major car accidents.
Oh my goodness.
And then I got thrown from a yellow banana boat. That's kind of a separate story. Like I remember flying through the air like a human frisbee. Going to end well. Boosh. I landed and ripped the hamstring off my pelvis.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. It was such a violent injury. Like literally, literally my ass was in a sling. So
yeah, people use that as like a euphemism, right? My ass is in a sling. You're literal ass in a sling. Wow. Oh my God.
After 2 months, I couldn't drive it. When they reattach it with the bone screws, you aren't allowed to bend more than a certain number of degrees, and it's graduated. So I couldn't even sit at 90 degrees for 2 months, which means I couldn't drive for 2 months.
Oh my God.
Anyway, so there's been a lot of detours along the way, but I'm a late bloomer.
Wow. Yes, exactly. The background is.
Feel like I'm picking up momentum. Like things are starting to work. I'm healthy. I'm good. I'm happy. And I love my work. It's so fun. So even though I've had those down periods, I was able to read and study and find things that were interesting to me, lecture, because that fit in really well into these overlays of medical downtime. I could pick where those were.
Yeah.
And then, worked for a couple of different groups. The family friend retired, worked for a couple of different groups. And then the COVID came, right?
Yeah.
And it was a great opportunity to just say, I think I'm finally ready to do it my way. And it was a natural breaking point. So that's what we did. We kind of moved everything into a dry eye centered clinic. Everything we do is centered around the needs of the dry eye patient.
Yeah. So let's just, because we're going to start talking about that in just 1 second. You finish your residency and your fellowship and you took 5 years off, where most people would be like, I got to get in there and get, you know, I got to do this now because whatever, we're rearing to go as soon as we're done getting our, you took the time off to start a family, which is beautiful. Then you fought off cancer. And then you had car accidents, and then you ripped your hamstring off your pelvis. And then you started a dry eye centered practice in the middle of the pandemic.
Yes.
And that's where we are now is like, holy, like, how do I can't even wrap my head around all of those things, like resilient and like, I don't even know how powerful person you must be to get through all of these things and to start to flourish, continue to flourish, even with all the challenges that we've been facing the last 12 months. So tell us about being the dry eye master and starting the Pyramid Institute.
There's a fun story in there. So I met my lead technician, Christine, 8 years ago, and she's amazing. She's incredibly hardworking, sort of that Norwegian work ethic, yeah. Heart of gold, mouth of a sailor, but we love that about her. And
all for it.
She said to me one day, Dr. Perriman, you really are the drive-by master. I'm like, oh, I don't know. You know, like, that feels a little braggadocious. I'm not sure I like that very much. And she's like, well, you are. And I've created your Instagram account. Here you go.
That's awesome.
I'm like, okay.
That's perfect.
And the name stuck. Yeah. So there you go.
I love it. I love it. It's great. It's perfect. It's perfect for social media, but it's obviously applicable and appropriate for you being a master in dry eye. Yeah. I love it.
And she's helped me create this institute. So when the COVID shutdown happened, I'm like, Christine, it's go time. Like, we've talked about this for years.
Yeah.
It's time. Let's do it. And she's like, okay, who do we got on the team? I'm like, it's you and me for now. and then we're going to bring on Raquel as soon as possible. She's my incredible licensed master esthetician, clinical research coordinator. And so it's kind of the three of us. We have a remote bookkeeper and that's it. We're small, we're mighty. And we have a worthy cause in doing everything we can for the dry eye patient. And we have a trusting team. And I think when you have those two key elements, there's not much that's going to get in your way.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. And tell me your thoughts and your opinions on the value of dry eye to a business, to an eye care business, to an eye care provider and a physician. You know, of course, this is what you do day in, day out. What about somebody who's thinking about building it into their practice or focusing more on it? Is there, I guess, money to be made, but are there people that need to be helped? You know, what's the scope of this?
Right. So I think, you know, for me, it's about meeting a need. Like, at the end of the day, it needs to pencil out because make sure the work family eats first, right? Mm-hmm. It's got to take care of people. But for me, it's really about easing human suffering. I suffer from dry eye myself, so I get it. It's not fun. And knowing that there's so much need out there drives me in a really positive way. Like it's all I think about. What can I do next? Is there any innovations out there? This patient's a little different. I have to think about this a little differently. So that part I find just my soul's purpose, if you will, I think that's why I was put here is to do this work. And it fills my heart.
That's amazing.
I love it so much. But to answer the practical part of your question, I think if you go to a place like Dry Eye University, put on by the Bowden Eye Clinic there in Florida, you will learn quickly the A to Z of what's available in dry eye as far as services and prescriptions and all this stuff. Like, you'll get that big A to Z perspective. But also Patty Barkey, who's a friend of mine, she does a brilliant job of showing you how the business part of it works. So rather than reinventing the wheel and being worried that you're missing opportunities or not counting the investment trajectory and the payoff or the, you know, paying off your investments, all those sorts of things, just go to Dry University at some point and really just listen and be a sponge. I had the good fortune of being a guest speaker there on several occasions.
Great.
And some of the other guest speakers would be like in and out. I'm like, I'm sticking around because there's a lot of good stuff to learn here.
Yeah.
And so I have to credit Dry University and Patty Markey for helping me learn the financial part. Because I'm a clinician scientist. I'm a medical doctor. Yeah. I'm not a business person. I have to learn to be if I'm going to survive. But that's not my primary focus. Right. It's just a necessary component.
Which is, yeah, well, exactly. It is. And that's something that I find is such a common theme. You know, I suppose I haven't heard it so much from ophthalmologists as I have because I spend more time talking to optometrists. But, you know, we're trained to be medical practitioners in some form or another and not business people. But it's great to know that there's resources out there that would help us. And shout out to my man, Jerry Robin, over at Bowden Eye Institute as well. I love him. I was very fortunate to cross paths with him when I was doing one of my clinics in Florida. So big shout out to them. Now, you know, you touched on this a little bit, the psychology of dry eye for the patient. I read somewhere, or the effect of quality of life dry eye has on a patient. And I read somewhere that some patients had rated it as high as having a severe attack of angina. That's how bad their dry eye can be sometimes, or how badly it affects their quality of life. That seems like maybe a little bit on the extreme side, but do you find that you, is that what a lot of your patients, or at least some of your patients, are experiencing? Their quality of life is severely diminished because of their dry eye symptoms?
It can get that bad. It very much can. It's not, and I'm sure you've experienced this, it's not out of the realm of possibility to have a patient who's suicidal out of their symptoms and their misery from it. And we need to prevent that and catch it earlier so that doesn't happen. So there's still a lot of, peer-to-peer connections to be made of helping each other diagnose this earlier, take charge earlier, and help prevent that tanker ship from crashing into the rocks. I think there's awareness that's growing, incredible educational platforms like the Canadian Dry Eye Summit. These are, and they also have a financial part, because I know that the business part in Canada is a little different than the US part. Mm-hmm. But it has to, like, we all want to help. We're helpers. Clinicians are helpers. We're doctors, right? But you also need to layer in this like mental health piece and helping patients with their anxiety and depression and learning to ask about it. Mm-hmm. Not everybody is going to be forthcoming about it. I think you need to have a radar for it, especially in family systems. This is pre-COVID, of course, because now like we limit the number of people in the room. But these family systems would come in and you'd see the patient and how much they're suffering. And sometimes the partner was super dialed in and sometimes they weren't, like a little tired of hearing about it. And this is one of the challenges of any kind of chronic disease, is the impact on family systems and support systems. And it can be really powerful to just be aware of that and have compassion for it. It's just a simple metric of, sitting alongside the patient or sitting with the patient and the partner, not at opposite ends, but like more like in a circle. Mm-hmm. And just say, I see your suffering. This is very real. It can ruin your day and make it really hard on the family. And then to just watch them all go, oh. And we can help. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Right. And just getting everybody on the same team. Like, it's like, I tried out for the cheerleading team, but I was really klutzy in high school, so I didn't make it. But but I'm having my chance to be a cheerleader now with my patients and reaching out to your other colleagues in other specialties. Like, sometimes you really need to reach out to your psychiatrist that can prescribe these medications. I'm not super comfortable prescribing those things. So there's a multidisciplinary approach, and it's so rewarding to really touch that person's heart and let them know that you're there, that you're not going anywhere, and that you're a team moving forward. Amazing. It can have a wonderful healing effect.
Yeah, I bet. And I imagine the patient really feels like you see them, you feel them in that moment. I can imagine many of these patients, most if not many of them, have just not necessarily been shrugged aside, but sort of said, oh, you have dry eye, like here's an eye drop, like okay, that, yeah, there you go. Not sat down and like, I see what you're going through and let's deal with this on a deeper level. So it's amazing that you take the time to do that.
But take the time to see, to hear, and to feel.
Yeah.
That's what, to me, that's what makes a good doctor.
Right. And I want to touch on that last part, the field. And you've kind of alluded to it a couple of times, that heart-centered approach. I'm curious because, I don't know if a lot of doctors take that heart-centered approach. And I wonder if you could share with us what that means and what somebody could do to start to take that type of approach.
Oh my gosh, that's an awesome question. I think it starts with our training. I think with our training, the MO is toughen up, buttercup, and just, pick yourself up and keep going. And, I think it's a mistake to treat humans, human physicians, human doctors, human optometrists as cogs in a wheel, if you're cogs in a machinery. We're human beings. We do have feelings. We do have needs. We need to have a sense of belonging and support, just like anybody else. And so I think that that old way of forcing us, or teaching, or modeling even, force your emotions to the side, stuff them down, don't talk about them, I think is passé. I think it's somewhat dangerous, because when you ignore big feelings, they can bottle up and they can spill out sideways and affect other parts of your life. Addiction problems, sleep disorders, family system stresses, happiness issues, you know, anxiety, depression, suicide happens in very high levels in the medical field.
Yeah. So what, for a doctor sitting in front of a patient, listening to the patient share their symptoms or their, what they're feeling, what do you suggest I do, you know, to see or feel that patient and really understand them better?
Oh my gosh, that's great. So I have a practical pearl that I would like to share, because
yeah, please.
I think you know, talking about feelings is kind of messy for a lot of people. It may not come easily. You can learn it, but it may not be natural or come easy. And it's a simple thing you can do. Instead of sitting across from someone, move your chair alongside them. Just that simple body language of sidling alongside someone conveys so much. And there's a lot of words that you don't need to have then, because you've demonstrated in your posture your commitment to hearing and your commitment to being on that journey with that patient.
Yeah, that's a nice tip, actually. I think we're so used to sitting across, you know, doctor, patient, face to face, kind of getting a little closer to the side there, that definitely would feel very different.
Feels very different, even for the doc.
Yeah, I'm just trying to put myself in that position. Yeah, it's almost like you're hanging out with a friend or a family member, and then you connect on a different level. That's a nice tip. Thank you very much. So let's take a quick change gears a little bit. You know, I like to, as you heard from the intro, you know, we're talking a little bit more in this podcast, a little bit more about business, entrepreneurship, that type of stuff. But it'd be, when you have the dry eye master, it's hard not to talk a little bit about clinical stuff. You know, one thing I wanted to touch on, you have this fun acronym, and you talk about the beauty and the beast. I have been getting more and more into dry eye over the last year, year and a half. And I find it extremely rewarding, like you're saying, and I'm starting to see people, you know, now and then what they're dealing with. So I connect with what you're saying. What you're saying resonates, but it's a tough condition to treat. Like, it's frustrating sometimes. It's stubborn. And you have this acronym that helps to kind of break it down. I'd love if you could share, you know, the story of the Bisto and what it is, what it means.
Sure. Thank you for that question. So, I read a lot of science, very science driven girl, but, when you read those white papers, so the one that I read that was the inspiration behind the Bisto was Christoph Badwin's BJO 2016 vicious circles paper.
Oh. Okay.
7 pages of mind blowing. That makes so much sense. But so what he talks about is 6 interrelated mechanisms of meibomian gland dysfunction. And he lists them off, and I'm thinking, who's going to remember that? Like, you need some kind of construct. You need an acronym to help remember these things. And so that's how, and this is how my crazy brain works, right? Like, I'm constantly singing songs to myself, writing poetry, like making up stuff. I don't know if you've ever seen my 80s dance party style dry eye lecture, but you get the idea.
I need to check that out. That's amazing. I need to find that.
Like, almost everything in the dry pathophysiology can be linked to an 80s song. So okay. That's kind of a fun little thing. But, back to the Bisto, rawr, the 6 interrelated mechanisms of meibomian gland dysfunction. This is based off of Christoph Badwin's work, who's brilliant clinician scientist out of France. And he's a TPOS News 2 committee member, all that good stuff. So there's, let's go through them. B is for bacteria and bugs. So that means like Demodex, right? We know that there's an altered microbiome with dry eye and MGD. Cool. We know the E is for enzymatic compromise. The biochemistry of microbiome production is exquisitely complex, and it requires genes to be transcribed and translated in just the right proportions to have just the right PK, along with the cofactors that you may or may not be getting from your diet, to do this complex chemical conversion from cholesterol to meibom. There's the maturation time within the meibomian gland itself, James Jester's work. So that's the E, enzymatic. I is inflammation, and we know from confocal microscopy that the meibomian glands are surrounded by activated T cells. And you can watch those go away with certain interventions, such as intense pulse light therapy. Hmm. Awesome paper, American Journal of Ophthalmology, 2018 or 19. Oops, I'll have to make sure. It was September 4th. Remember that.
I'm astounded by the capacity to retain all this information. But please
continue. Because it's interesting. That's why it sticks.
Yeah that's true.
So that's the eye of the Visto. S is for stasis or constipation of the meibomian glands, right? That sludgy stuff just gets stuck in there. That's stasis. T is altered melting temperature. That's why we use hot packs, trying to liquefy the waxy, abnormal lipid meibom. And then finally, O is obstruction. And that can be anywhere from the terminal ductal, that hyperkeratinized snowbank effect that you see that you want to scrape off. And it can be inside the duct, like as a cicatricial change, where we have to go in with mask and probing to dilate that cicatricial canal. It can be a hyperkeratinization. We know that in MGD, you have these keratin disulfide bonds that can only be broken with high heat outside of the tolerability limits of human tissue, 150 degrees. You're going to cook the lid if you do that. You can't do that. Right. Or you can break it chemically with a selenium disulfide, which is in clinical phase 3 trials in Australia from a company called Azura. Wow. So this is the construct of the Visto, and I don't have anything in my toolkit that kills all 6 heads of the Visto.
Right.
This is why we layer on therapy. And once you understand that, then you're like, oh, well, that's why this fancy in-office thermal pulsation thing that I bought works some of the time, and not all the time. Right. Because you can layer on the other components of the Visto. Understand where your technology fits. Understand where the gaps are in your treatment algorithm, and make sure you've got all your bases covered. And you do that with a combination of your nutraceuticals. I'm a huge fan of Hydri, with your hypochlorous acid sprays, with your immunomodulators, cyclosporin, lefitograst, allergy control. That's a huge driver of meibomian gland dysfunction. That is Nancy Reyes and Danny Sabin's work out of Duke. There's an immunologic bridge between allergic conjunctivitis and meibomian gland dysfunction. Mm. Got to treat it. My fellows wrote an article for Contact Lens periodical. I think it's Contact Lens Spectrum. It's coming out next month, I think. And I helped them develop this article looking at the landscape of allergic conjunctivitis. And they did such a good job. I'm so proud of my fellows. That article is coming out next month, and hopefully that'll help to explain that whole immunologic bridge story a little bit more. Yeah. I talk about it a lot in my review paper. I had 2 review papers last year on cyclosporin mechanism of action and lefitograst mechanism of action.
That's amazing. So,
that was a long-winded answer. Sorry.
No, that's great. Well, to recap then, and I hope everyone's taking notes who's listening here. To recap, Visto is B for bugs, E for enzymatic, I for inflammation, S for stasis, T for temperature, and O for obstruction. And those are the 6 heads of the Visto, right? So you're talking about the beast, this beast that we have to slay, that is dry eye, that is MGD. Those are the 6 heads that we have to slay to really defeat the beast. So that's really cool. I love that you put it into that. And It's a lot easier to remember when you have an acronym and visualization and all of that. So it's cool that
it's a lot more fun.
Then it's a lot more fun. Imagine saying that, oh, we've slain three of the heads. We have three to go. The patient's like, yeah. We're halfway there. I'm trying to say we're halfway there.
For the right patient, that would be fun to share, but be careful with that one.
Yeah, I can now, I'm like imagining having like a poster of like a dragon with six heads and like, anyways, go off on a whole different tangent there.
And it's a framework for putting on our new technologies, right?
Yeah.
So as a new med comes in, as a new in-office procedure comes in, you're like, okay, so how does this help me get the beast out or R, you know?
Exactly.
My sword of truth. How does it help me Joan of Arc slay all these heads?
That's exactly it. And I think it'll make dry eye a lot more fun for those practitioners who are like, oh, should I go into it? Now you're going to be slaying a six-headed beast, not just treating a patient's dry eye. So it's a lot more fun now. On that note, one last question on this clinical side of things. You've already touched on something briefly yourself in that answer, but what is there something on the horizon that you're excited about, treatment or, you know, medication or something that you know is coming that maybe the majority of practitioners are not aware of that you think will be super exciting?
Oh my gosh, it's such a great question. The innovations are really exciting and there's a ton. Like, this is an amazing time to be a dry eye physician, a dry eye doctor, and a dry eye patient. Like, it's good to be living in these modern times, right? Right. So we've got in the pharmaceutical front, we have a novel TRPV1 antagonist that's being studied for corneal pain after refractive surgery. So cool.
That will be good.
Yeah, the TRP is a super family of receptors, and they have this interesting that all the different subtypes have immunomodulatory, nociceptive modulatory capabilities. This huge super family of receptors, but now we're going to have something targeted towards one of them. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
I'm excited about the new waterless drops coming to the US. They're in phase 3 development here. Waterless artificial tear from Novaliq in Europe. And cool. Because it's water-free, you can solubilize cyclosporin really easily in it, right? Because that's the challenge, is cyclosporin is Jack Spratt's wife. It can eat no lean. It can only be around fat. And so you have to treat it that way. And that's why it's such a challenge to formulate with.
Right.
So I think there's still a lot of, and that needs the Azura molecule I was talking about.
This whole
idea of if you think of that hyperkeratinization as being a little bit like a blackhead, it's keratin that's just this form, this plug that we have to solubilize, so that, like, unclogging the hair and grease in a sink, essentially. So having something to break that down so that things can flow. I think we'll be seeing What's that?
So it's like Drano for the MGD. I'm sorry, that's a
kinda, but yeah. Don't use Drano on your eyelids.
Use Drano.
we can release that hairball surrounded by fat. That'd be great.
Yeah. Awesome.
I think you're going to see a lot more home therapies, home devices coming to the fore. We're excited about those as well. Let's see, what else am I super excited about? The pharmacologics, the home devices, the emphasis on nutraceuticals is coming back around. I think people have a renewed interest in health.
And I think I've found that myself, as practitioners and patients alike have this more, the more interest in this sort of holistic approach. What's the best sort of complete strategy for this, not just eye drop, not just treatment, like, how do I just feel better and how am I going to be more healthy? So that's good to hear, and those are all exciting things. I didn't know about any of those.
And neural stimulation, that's coming to Canada soon.
Neural stimulation, yes, I've seen.
We participated in the phase 3 FDA trials for the eye tear, and it's cool. I use that thing clinically all the time. It's fantastic.
That's cool to hear.
My gosh, I can't wait to share. I can't wait to hear what your clinical experience is, but it's a brilliant tool for anyone who's had corneal, contact lens over where the corneal nerves are a little bit shrunken down, LASIK, PRK, cataract surgery, autoimmune disease. Those are home runs, man. The heavy computer users, NeuroStim all day long.
That's quite a lot of people who could benefit from that. I haven't had a chance to, I've learned a little bit. I'm looking forward to potentially getting a chance to test one out in the next little while, but I'm glad to hear that you've had such good feedback from it.
IPL? I can go on and on.
Well, of course. IPL. Well, I think IPL and radio frequency and some of these other treatments are becoming a little bit more, not as widespread, but they're becoming a little bit more used and understood by kind of the majority of practitioners now. Even if they don't have them necessarily in their office, they know that they're there. But to hear that there's some more of this cool cutting edge stuff coming around, that's really exciting.
Yes.
I've been very fortunate to have some really successful and well-established female entrepreneurs and athletes. In fact, a gold medal Olympic athlete and yourself, you know, on the show. And every time I get an opportunity, I'd love to ask you a question about how we can improve the situation as far as a gender gap or inequality in professions and in business. And if you can share your insights as to, you know, what your journey has been, and if you have words of wisdom to share with others, you know, who are coming up in your footsteps or behind you.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that. Even though I trained in an era where the gender inequality was pretty blatant, it's still there. It's just less blatant. So I think there's still a lot of room for growth. Even in my 50s, I'm still dealing with gender bias stuff, not on an infrequent basis. So it's okay to acknowledge it. It's okay to kindly point it out and ask for everyone to do a little better. But I will say that the younger generation, I love mentoring and speaking with them because they've got an equity mindset baked in. They're already wired that way. And I find that the future looks bright. We've got so many incredible leaders coming up. And they have that equity mindset. So I think it's going to take a generational shift. And for people that are afraid of equity things, just for them to see that just because other people are getting more doesn't mean that there's less for you. There's enough for everyone. And so taking on that abundance mindset, that growth mindset, then people aren't so afraid of losing everything. It's not a zero sum game. Mm. It's a endless possibility. If you think in the infinite, what's possible?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And applying that mindset to that specific topic is actually really valuable, I think, as well. You know, thinking of it as this infinite game, as you were talking about earlier, and having this abundance mindset can be beneficial in all aspects, and definitely when we're talking about gender equality as well. I think that is, in some cases, the fear. People who want to maintain the status quo are afraid that they're going to lose what they have, and that's not necessarily the case. In some cases it might be, but hopefully it's just for the better overall, for the greater good anyways.
Greater good.
So I wanted it to shift to at the end of every podcast, I have two questions I like to ask every guest, but before we get to those, I have five quick kind of rapid fire questions for you. If you're ready, we're going to try and do this, one word to one sentence, kind of as quick as you can fire them off. Okay.
Hit me.
All right. If there was an eye drop apocalypse and there was only one eye drop you could save, what would it be?
Only one eye drop I could save?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're making me pick a favorite child. That's mean.
That's exactly what I mean.
Oh, this is making me uncomfortable. Okay, all right.
I'm sorry if that
was... No, in a good way. I'm like, it's forcing me to... that's a really hard question.
And be like, Dr. Perriman, you didn't talk about my eye drop, one of your reps.
I know, exactly. Can I flip it just a little and say what I would want to keep in my ideal eye drop?
Sure. Let's do that.
You're very generous. Thank you.
And then we can deduce from that which drop you're maybe referring to. Go ahead.
That's awesome. So I think it needs to have a little bit of hyaluronic acid, a little bit of tremolose for preventing autophagy, right? And to help prevent the conversion from innate to adaptive immunity, it needs to have cofactors, needs to have a little bit of glycerin, and it needs to be preservative free.
Okay, good. That's the eye drop. If that's on your shelf, you're going to save that during the eye drop apocalypse.
That's a great question.
Who was the biggest influence on you early in your medical career?
Oh, that's easy. Douglas Powell, internal medicine. I was a med student at the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic before we had highly active antiretroviral therapy. And these incredible people would be dying of very strange diseases because their immune systems were gone. And my mentor, Douglas Powell, the most inspired physician I've ever encountered. He approached everyone with compassion and care and teamwork. And I think I picked up a lot of things from him, just that simple act of sitting beside someone and conveying that compassion and I'm here for you. Oh, this is supposed to be rapid fire. Sorry, fine, Douglas Powell.
Nope. I'm going to edit right there. I'm going to assume the first time you said his name, I'm just kidding. That's a good I'll let it be. All right. Biggest lesson you have learned from COVID?
If you're handed a bushel full of lemons, make lemonade.
I love it. Start a business in the middle of the pandemic. What's the biggest publication you've been featured in?
You mean like published papers?
Sure. Or if somebody wrote about you somewhere, whatever, either way.
Oh, well, I will say that I'm absolutely floored to be on the Ophthalmologist Power 100 list. That is incredibly meaningful to me.
Yeah. Incredible. And congratulations. What an achievement. That's
amazing.
Well deserved. I'm sure everybody who's listening or watching agrees it's well deserved. And finally, if you were not a medical doctor, and I know you said you wanted to be one since you were a kid, but if you weren't, what would you be?
I'd be an actor.
I knew it. And a good one too.
Oh, thanks.
All right. And then the final two questions, these can be a little longer if you wish. The first one is, if we could hop in a time machine and head back to a point in your life where you needed some advice, maybe a difficult point. You can share that moment of what actually was happening. You don't have to, but if you'd like to, you can. But more importantly, what advice would you give to yourself at that time?
It would have been as a med student. I went through a very dark period of depression. It was very intense. I had wonderful friends. But depression is a kind of a private journey sometimes. And I would go back and say to myself, just try looking at it in a different way.
Yeah. That's powerful advice, I think, for somebody who's going through something that difficult. But also, I think maybe just in everyday life, that might be helpful for us in a lot of situations, right? Maybe just try looking through it a different lens or looking at it a different way. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for sharing that that time as well. And the last question is, everything that you've achieved to becoming the dry eye master on this list of top 100 women in ophthalmology and everything else, how much of it would you say is due to luck and how much is due to hard work?
I will say neither. It's about friendships and community. There's no way I'd be anywhere without friendships and community. Mm.
Okay, great. Going off the grid. I like it.
That's what I do.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Pearman, can you tell us where we can find you, whether online or social media? Where can we find you? Where can we connect with you? And any final words that you'd like to share with us before we wrap up?
Sure. My website is dryeyemaster.com. I've got two portals, one for patients, one for clinicians. It's got all kinds of interesting stuff, upcoming clinical studies, some really nice cases. We've got a photo gallery of cases, little blurbs, articles I've written are all on there. I hope you enjoy it. You can find me on Instagram at dryeyemaster. I'm still kind of learning Instagram and I take I take cues from people who are doing an amazing job with it, like you. So I'm still learning that one a little bit. I mess up a little. I'm on Twitter as Dry Eye Monster and Facebook. Laura M. Perryman is my personal, and my professional is Laura M. Perryman, MD. And join us on Ocular Surface Docs on Facebook, OSD, OCS. It's one of the administrators, and it's a lovely community, international community of doctors who are passionate about dry eye. We have about 6,000 members from around the world. Wow. It's close to industry, and so that helps us talk very collegially with each other. Everybody's super cool, super nice, and there's some really funny people in there too, but it's just a wonderful, supportive community.
That's awesome. So it's OSD OCS?
Yes, on Facebook. You have to send us a request to join, and then just fill out the questions so that we know that you are indeed a clinician or a staff member, and you're involved in eye care.
Right. Amazing. Thank you again, Dr. Perryman. Also, honestly, such an amazing pleasure to have you on the podcast. I really can't wait to get this out there. And there, as you know from our earlier discussion, there's a lot of topics we didn't cover. So I would love to have you back for part two at some point in the future. And thank you to everybody who is tuning in, listening, watching. Thank you so much for the support. Do not forget to hit subscribe, whether you're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you are. Leave a comment. Let me know what you thought. And take a screenshot and tag us both, Dry Eye Master and HarbirSand.od, and let us know what you liked about this episode, what you took away from it. And we'll see you all again soon. Take care, guys.